FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's March 28th, 2018. Well, you've seen lots of turmoil, lots of turnover in the Trump White House. It seems like every time you pick up the papers, there's somebody who's been fired and someone else who's been hired. But what else did you expect? It is Trump, after all. And after all, just be part of the show. Email us, kl@kerrylutz.com. Or leave a message on the hotline, 914-424-4142. So what's going on in the Trump White House? What about Gina Haspel and Mike Pompeo? Pompeo heading from head of the CIA to the State Department, Secretary of State. Gina Haspel, first female to take on the helm of the CIA. Is it good, bad, or does it matter? Well, our good friend is with us, Bruce Thornton. Bruce, your research fellow at the Hoover Institution, a professor at Cal State U, and as well as always a frequent contributor to Front Page Mag, as well as being author of 10 books. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So, is this turmoil or is this a positive, moving these two people into leadership positions in the White House?
Oh, I wouldn't say it's turmoil. I mean, a lot of that is the media, you know, putting a magnifying glass on stuff that happens in every administration. And it's definitely a positive. At the time that Rex Tillerson was appointed, I thought, I don't see anything in this man's background that would make him a good Secretary of State. So replacing him with Pompeo, who is much, much more suited for that job, is a positive. For one thing, someone like Rex Tillerson, who's a CEO of a multinational global company, takes that attitude of the global elite. And that attitude, particularly in foreign policy, which favors, you know, multilateralism, consensus, coalitions, et cetera. In other words, it favors talking a lot and not doing a lot. So getting in somebody who's going to be a man of action and who understands that talk in foreign policy without a credible threat of force doesn't get anything done. So that's a great improvement.
So Gina Haspel, she's been very controversial. It seems like she's been slandered, claims that she was in charge of a black site where prisoners from the war on terror were brought to and renditioned, whatever, and tortured. But this has turned out to not be exactly the case, is it?
No, that as soon as that New York Times editorial said that, it had already been discredited on the facts of the matter. But the bigger issue is this, you know, the whole torture meme during the Bush administration was an instrument to discredit the Bush administration and its foreign policy. And that in turn was a consequence of the leading Democrats who had voted for the war in Iraq, remember, suddenly realizing that the anti-war attitude was going to help them in the presidential primaries. So the whole thing was politicized from the start. More specifically, what they're trying to resurrect is this lie that waterboarding, which happened only three times on three suspects, and was effective in generating information. Three different ex-heads of the CIA have said this, that was torture, that waterboarding was torture. And that too is a lie, and it has been exposed as a lie over and over and over again. So it's really despicable to see them, you know, that is the Democrats in the Senate, who are opposed to anything that, you know, Donald Trump does, right? Mm-hmm. And they're looking for any excuse to denigrate him and his administration. To bring that up and slander a 30-year veteran, by all accounts, bipartisan accounts, a fantastic CIA agent personnel right where she should be, where she's earned her way to be, to have them now try to dredge up this old lie about waterboarding, I think is really low.
Yeah, and especially because we know it's not true. And, you know, the misrepresentation that torture was somehow the policy of the U.S. government for holding these people is ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars per year providing these prisoners with medical care, prayer rugs, prayer books. I mean, they had everything, but even I think they even had internet access. So what is all this talk about here, Bruce? I don't get it.
Yeah.
And they should be thrilled that a woman is running the CIA. That should have made their day. I mean, they're all about female empowerment, aren't they?
But we know, look, we've known, I'm in the university, so I've known it years ago, you know, but now it's everywhere and everybody knows it. It's been at least two decades since feminism has become a political wing, a wing of the progressive Democrats. And it's not about whether women achieve, it's about whether women of the right ideology advance. And just remember what they did to Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
Right. That was, you know, how can anybody treat a quote sister like that, a woman of achievement, and not one who was born into it like most of the feminists who come from the upper middle class or upper class, but an ordinary person gets to be governor and then is selected as a vice president candidate and really saved McCain's campaign at that point. If you go back and look at the polls before and after, and that tells you that this isn't about women's rights. This isn't about, you know, advancing women. It's about their political ideology and one in which they have the power. And you see the same thing with conservative blacks like Thomas Sowell or, you know, others. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how hard their upbringing, Clarence Thomas, I mean, compare his childhood to, you know, some of these so-called self-proclaimed black figures on our scene. And yet he is treated worse than or as bad as a Jim Crow segregationist would. So we know that it's not about that. But the other point I think is it bears repeating. This whole waterboarding is torture or enhanced interrogation techniques, right? And this included things like playing loud music, keeping the lights on, sometimes slamming people against the wall, creating fear in them. The idea that that was torture, which brings up in people's minds the worst sorts of examples of torture, that was despicable. And particularly waterboarding, because I think around 30,000 U.S. military personnel had been waterboarded as part of their training. And Eric Holder was asked in 2009, I think, testifying before Congress. And a congressman said, well, you know, these guys were subjected to waterboarding as part of their training. And were they tortured? And Holder said exactly what the law says. And he said, no, because under U.S. statute, and that's key to remember, this is U.S. law passed in the 90s. Under U.S. statute, you have to have an intent to create lasting or permanent physical or psychological damage. And obviously, for our personnel who were waterboarded, that didn't happen. So everybody knew that. Everybody knew that this was a canard, that it was weaponized. The enhanced interrogation techniques were weaponized in order to score political points. And it's interesting, the one of the first things Obama did when he got into office is he wrote an executive order saying you can't use waterboarding and other enhanced interrogation techniques. Which, of course, alerted our enemy that, hey, you know, you're not going to have to be faced with these interrogation techniques. So instead, what does Obama do? His whole term, instead of capturing these guys so they can be interrogated for intelligence, he drones them to death.
Yeah, much more humane.
Them, he kills whoever's standing around them, you know. Mm-hmm. And somehow that's more humane than a interrogation technique we use on our own military is preposterous.
Yeah, quite preposterous. I mean, you can take issue whether it's effective or not. and whether that should be the policy. But it doesn't really rise to the type of torture that we've seen our soldiers subjected to in many theaters, in many prisoner of war camps throughout the 20th century and even to present. Yeah. So,
well, you know, listen, several reporters volunteered to be waterboarded. All right. I remember Christopher Hitchens, you know, lasted like about two pours and stopped.
Yeah.
Here's a rule everybody should keep in mind. If a journalist volunteers to have this done to him, it isn't torture by definition.
Hey,
because no journalist is going to volunteer to have his fingernails ripped out with a pair of pliers.
Of course not.
And that's torture.
And look, I will tell you that listening to my kids' music, if they're blasting it and I can't hear myself think, that definitely is more torture than waterboarding.
Yeah.
You know, some
my
of this rap music.
My lectures are torture, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Tortures in
I'll
the eyes.
I'll go to Guantanamo and I'll you know, pitch in.
Yeah, and like having a woman humiliate a Muslim, dress provocatively and talk down to him, and that's torture too, right? So what are we talking about here really, Mark? Is this just a bunch of rhetoric, a bunch of nonsense just to make the country look bad or what?
Yeah, I mean, remember, the progressive Democrats, which increasingly now that's redundant, they're all progressives pretty much, they are globalists and internationalists. They really care about what particularly Europe says about us. Okay. And they don't want us doing anything that shows that we believe in our nation and its exceptionalism and that it has the right to protect its interests and security of its citizens, of the sovereign people. And so if the Europeans start insulting us and calling us names and tortures and everything, then they clutch their pearls and they want to say, oh, well, let's assure them that that's not us. That's those wicked, evil, fascist Republicans, right? And so that really damages, it did during the Obama administration, it really damaged our credibility with our rivals and enemies. Because all that was a big projection of weakness and a lack of morale and a lack of will. And hopefully under this president and with his new with National Security Advisor John Bolton, I mean, that was an inspired choice, that we can start correcting or continue to correct, I should say, because President Trump has taken some actions, that the deterrent of prestige when enemies know you will punish them and friends know you will have their backs. And if you don't have that, then it doesn't matter how many carrier battle groups you have or whatever, you're not going to be effective.
Very true. So speaking of Bolton, controversial pick, basically portrayed by the media, he's going to get us into World War III or IV, and look out below because we are, you know, he's irresponsible.
Right.
He's a warmonger, right? I mean, all of these things,
yeah.
Bruce. And, you know, the guy, I think you could make the argument that he is more, I don't want to say militant, but more perhaps to the right than just about anyone who's been in the position lately. But has he shown anything that makes you believe that he's going to get us into World War III?
No, look, this has been the Democrats' weapon going back to Barry Goldwater and the famous ad of the little
daisy.
Girl picking daisies and then a nuclear bomb.
Right.
They did it to Ronald Reagan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was the exact same things. When Ronald Reagan, remember when he started the Strategic Defense Initiative?
Sure.
And put the missiles in Europe? And, oh, my gosh, this was going to cause World War III. You know, he's a warmonger. He's got an itchy thumb on the nuclear button, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There were 2 million people marching against putting those missiles in Europe. And that was one of the turning points in the Cold War and in the end of the Cold War. So this is what they do. And it doesn't matter if it's true. They create a caricature. They say it over and over again and try to make it into reality. And there's nothing that John Bolton has done other than say that it is our right to defend our interests without permission, without having to get the UN to get behind us and say we can do it because we are a sovereign nation. And the government's first priority, its first duty, its first responsibility for the sovereign people is to keep them safe and to protect their interests. So he's simply going back to what everybody understood foreign policy to be since the founding. And so, as I said before, since the people that don't like him are internationalists and they like going to the UN speechifying or you know,
naval
shuttle
gazing.
Diplomacy.
Naval gazing.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, naval gazing.
Pure
yeah.
Naval gazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So no, he's everything's same. And he ain't even saying he's a neocon. That's not true. That's patently false.
What is a neocon?
Anybody
exactly?
Anybody that says that.
What is a neocon? I'd love to know because I still don't get it at this point in my life. Maybe I'm a little dense. I just don't really understand what they, you know, they're very free to, you know, generous with that term, but I never really quite understand what it means.
Well, originally there were a lot of Democrat hawks. Remember when the Democratic Party had hawks?
No, you know, like Scoop Jackson. Yeah, Scoop Jackson.
Yeah, and so Scoop yeah. Jackson. All right. So a lot of liberals who had been, let's say, conservative Democrats or anti-communist Democrats or hawkish Democrats, when they saw the culture begin to turn, particularly in the 60s and the 70s, particularly under Jimmy Carter, away from vigorously defending our security and interests and our way of life to internationalism, they felt that they had to, you know, change their allegiance, at least their political allegiance, in the area of foreign policy, not in terms of everything, all right, but in the area of foreign policy. And they came collectively to be called the neocons. Now, that was turned into an epithet because they were very vigorous about the war in Iraq in 2003.
Mm.
And so when that started to go awry, and mainly because of the naive nation building program that George W. Bush started promoting, which neocons sort of are get behind too, some of them, then it became an insult because now they're warmongers. They got us into this disastrous war in Iraq, which we know only became a disaster when Obama took over and ran away and created the vacuum that now Iran and Russia are filling. And one more point that's interesting, and nobody will admit this, okay? By chance, a lot of the first neocons were Jewish intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
So for many people, when they use neocon, right, it's a real kind of soft anti-Semitism. Because they are also supporters of Israel,
right,
and vigorous in support of Israel. So sometimes you'll hear some of these people on the left saying, "Oh, he's just a neocon," and there's like a little subtitle: "He's a Jew." You see what I mean?
Yeah,
I've seen that over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's code word. I hate to use that liberal
exactly.
term. That liberal term that I really despise every time I hear it. But it's a dog whistle.
Dog right? whistle. Oh,
yeah,
absolutely.
Like, ugh. You know, that yeah. is like the worst term.
But it's a real one.
Yeah. But it's really aggravating to hear that. Like it's somehow acceptable in the public dialogue that anyway. So
it's the problem with that. That's mainly used in racial situations. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you in that context, because the old school real racist behavior all through up until the Civil Rights Act in the 60s, that's pretty much gone away. Legal segregation has gone away. You look at opinion polls on racial relations, you know, yeah, I'm sure some counties, some place you have old school, you know, neo-Klansmen or something, but they're negligible and their influence on society is completely negligible. But you want to keep the racist attack, the attack on racism, because that's where grievance politics gets its power, right?
Sure.
If there's no grievance, then why do you exist?
Yeah.
So the dog whistle is a way of saying, well, it doesn't sound racist, just like a dog can hear a sound we can't hear, but racists can hear it, right? They can decode this innocuous statement about crime or something and say, oh, no, it's not really about that. It's about racism. They're communicating with their, you know, constituents. So, yeah, that's just preposterous.
Yeah. And Bolton Yeah, like some of his positions, you know, like North Korea, like Iran, consider attacking them, confronting them militarily, could seem perhaps extreme. But just because you espouse a position doesn't mean that that's what you really want to do. It can often be a means of achieving another goal, of achieving the goal of not using force to get what you want.
Exactly. And as I said before, and this is what Bolton understands, you know, the whole big deal about diplomacy, you know, we need to use diplomacy. We need smart diplomacy. See, that was the cliche that Obama and those who agree with him always use. Well, we have to have smart diplomacy. Well, we had diplomacy for 30 years in North Korea and they got a bomb. Right? The diplomacy in Iraq is going to ensure probably with under a decade, they're going to have a bomb. Now, what Bolton understands is, he doesn't say, you know, like Ross do that in the Times said, oh, well, he doesn't like diplomacy. He just wants to go military. That's stupid. What he understands is that diplomacy works if and only if they believe that you have force backing your words and that you will use it when they do not live up to any agreement or any term. Thomas Hobbes had a great, great quote from Leviathan. Covenants without the sword are mere words and will not keep a man safe. A treaty, an agreement, anything created by diplomacy will only be effective if behind it is your adversary believes sincerely that you will use force to make that diplomacy work. And what we did is we moved away from that and after the Cold War. And it was like, no, we have international institutions now, and they'll be able to adjudicate conflicts. And that's just preposterous.
Yeah, right? that didn't work out too well.
No, it didn't. And the Iran deal is the culmination historically, right? The only reason it's not as bad as Munich is it's not going to lead to a global conflict the way Munich did. But it is, you know, it's the same stupidity or blindness as thinking. And this is a point the great historian of Soviet terror, Robert Conquest, made. You cannot go into a negotiation and assume that the person sitting across from you thinks just the way you do, believes the way you do, shares the same morals, the same mores, the same ambitions, or the same values that you have. You have to assume he's there to maximize his country's interests, and you are there to maximize your country's interests. And to make that work, there has to be a credible threat of force. And that's what Reagan did with the missiles, they derided it to Star Wars initiative, anti-missile technology, which of course now everybody's talking about, and in Grenada, in pushing back in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. He said, no, you know, Jimmy Carter's gone. He's not here now. We are going to push back wherever we can, and we're going to make you have to try to have your rickety failing economy keep up with us in terms of weapons development. And it worked.
It turned out to be a brilliant move, a brilliant strategery, if you will.
And
nobody really, even to this day, they won't give him credit for it, but it really did work.
Very quickly, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we were in Berlin last year with a tour that I do, Victor Hansen, and I had the old checkpoint Charlie, right? The crossing between East and West Berlin. They have rebuilt it. It's a really cheesy, it really is. I mean, our guide told us the two guys dressed up like American GIs were actually male strippers. But anyway, So they had this on the street flanking it. They had this billboard, right? And it was the whole story of the Cold War and the end of the Cold War. And you start and you walk past and you walk past and then you to the end. And one of the members of our group, he just went ballistic on our poor guide. Aww. He said, you know what? We've gone through this whole display, and who's not here? Not even mentioned by name, let alone a photograph.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan's not here. Margaret Thatcher's not here. John Paul II's not here.
Yeah,
you gotta be ashamed of yourself. So you're right.
Yeah,
you're right. They try to Trotsky him out of the photograph. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Airbrush him out of that history.
Oh, you're so right on. I mean, look, Especially like when it was going on, you know, understand people having doubts about it. It's potentially a dangerous strategy at first blanch. But when you look back, and then you look back at his writings, all right, Reagan's writings, he was always a dummy as far as the left was concerned. Mm-hmm. You know, he couldn't tie his shoes when he got to bed in the morning. But his writings showed somebody completely different, who was very astute, very subtle, sublime, and knew exactly what he was doing. And then for them to just crop the picture, as you will, Photoshop yep. these three key players out of history is, it's revisionist history at its worst.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Of course. And I remember when Saturday Night Live, there'd be a skit with Reagan and he'd fall over and there's a big cheese coming out of his back, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And what people didn't understand is Ronald Reagan didn't come from nowhere. He was governor two terms in California. Before that, he saw the communist enemy in the fights in the studios during the late 40s and early 50s, right? He saw how they fought. He saw how they were supported by Moscow, how their agenda was directed by Moscow. And he fought that battle in that venue. And so he had no illusions about the nature of communism and what it meant. And then he spent another decade going around the country, honing his speeches, honing his message, using his communication skills to get that communicated to people. And so when he finally became president in 1980, he had at least 20 years experience in exactly this issue that we're talking about, right? The true nature of communism and its threat during the Cold War. And he just wasn't a simple guy who just happened to be able to speak well. He had prepared himself for a long time.
Arguably, much like Donald Trump has prepared himself for the so-called draining of the swamp. Hey, we got to leave it at that. Where's the best place to find your work and connect with you on the web?
Probably Front Page Mag. They have an author archive for all of us. And click on that and you'll see all of, you know, stuff I've done. I also have one at Hoover, and they sometimes have other stuff too. But that's the best place to go because I'm in there five times a month.
Okay, great. And we read you regularly. And if you want to be part of the show, participate, just email us, kl@carrylutz.com. The hotline just set up, 914-424-4142. And the Twitter feed's @CarryLutz. Bruce, always great to have you on. We'll talk to you again real soon.
All right, my friend. Take care.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.